Space Kids Global heads to space, and a mission to Venus is back on track. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The organization Space Kids Global is bringing space to everyone. The STEAM educational program inspires kids to pursue a career in the space industry. Blue Origin astronaut Sharon Hagel is bringing a group of 8 lucky kids to watch her journey back to space aboard a New Shepard capsule. We'll speak with Sharon about this upcoming mission and the message she wants to share with the next generation. Then after 30 years, NASA is going back to the hottest planet in our solar system. The Veritas mission to Venus is back on track after NASA defunded the program 2 years ago. We'll speak with Dyer about the mission and what she hopes to find about Venus and its similarities to Earth. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? In 2022, Sharon Hagel and her husband Mark became the first married couple to fly to space together. Sharon is preparing to launch once again, but with a special audience this time. Sharon is the founder of Space Kids Global, an organization that seeks to educate and inspire the youth to be excited about space and STEAM education, and hopefully find careers in the space industry. The upcoming contest from Space Kids Global will choose 8 lucky kids to watch the upcoming New Shepard launch from the control room and act as a press squad, interviewing engineers, astronauts, spacecraft managers, and more. Here to talk more about her mission and her nonprofit organization is Space Kids Global founder and Blue Origin astronaut Sharon Hagel. Sharon, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you guys for having me back again.
Of course. Sharon, last time we talked, you were preparing for a Blue Origin New Shepard launch. You're going on another one, right? And you want to take some folks with you. Tell us a bit about what's coming up.
Oh, this is going to be an exciting launch. Not only are Mark and I going back, but we're taking 8 lucky kids from across the country. Different categories, actually. There's going to be one from first responders, one from the military family, one from Boys and Girls Club, and the other 5 will be geographically selected from zones across the country.
Tell a bit about how this contest works. What are you looking for?
We're looking for kids that are really interested in the space industry. They're between the ages of 8 and 12, U.S. students from any type of schooling. And we want them to be excited about their futures in space. So we've formed this press squad. And what that really means is they're going to be space reporters.
Ooh.
So every child will be flown into Orlando. And then from there, we'll transport them out to the beach. And they'll have access to Blue Origin's rocket plant. They'll be able to interview some of the workers there, the scientists, the designers, and find out what the new jobs in space is all about. They'll have an opportunity to interview us, too, out in Van Horn, Texas. But the best part is they'll be watching the live webcast from Blue Origin's facility at Kennedy Space Center in Mission Control.
Ooh, very cool.
Oh, my God, that place is so futuristic. They're going to be taken away.
This space reporter is very jealous because I have yet to see the Blue Origin factory and Blue Origin Mission Control. So they are going to be able to scoop us on that. That is so cool. Sharon, you're going to be taking another flight. I think I know the answer to this question, but why are you going back? If our listeners can only see your face.
Why not?
Okay, that's what I thought. That's what I thought the answer was going to be.
I mean, seriously, we are so fortunate to have this opportunity, and especially so early on in the space exploration. But let's don't lose the whole goal, and that is to get more people up there. What we tell our students is that every career we have down here, we're going to need up there. Do you know the first thing that the elementary school kids tell me is they think the only job in the space industry is an astronaut. We've got to change that message. Like I said, space is for everyone, and what we have here, we're going to need up there. That means farmers, mechanics, seamstress, all the things we have here.
Tell us a bit about the work that Space Kids Global is doing to change that mindset. I know you've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of students about your passion for space and for trying to change this paradigm and the way that we think about living and working in space. What is Space Kids Global aim to do?
We want to bring the possibility of space to kids everywhere, and that means everybody. One of the things that we've been working on with Orange County Public School is that we I guess it was last year, we brought 274 kids out to KSC, the visitor complex, from Title I schools, and they were fourth graders. And the reason that they're fourth graders is that's why the school system starts teaching about space exploration. We just signed up for another 374 kids to go over. So if you ask children that are underserved what they want to be when they grow up, it's what they've seen. Mm-hmm. And that's either a teacher, a janitor, or a cafeteria worker. When you take these kids over to KSC and show them what's going to happen in their future, their eyes light up.
As someone who is so connected to young people and igniting that passion within them, you've been doing this for quite a few years now. Are you optimistic that this is reaching enough kids? And we're going to be set in the future? Or is there still a lot of work to be done to make sure that we have this workforce that knows about these opportunities?
Yes, I do think we're making a difference. I think, you know, I've been doing this for almost 10 years now, and I can see the kids getting excited about their future. You know, the present educational program is not working for some. And what Space Kids does is we want to bring hands-on projects to kids so that they are participators, not spectators. And the way we do that is working with our space companies or schools. Recently, we sent 21 science projects to the ISS. We've had an essay competition about why do you want to go to space? And the winners got to take a zero gravity flight, which blew their mind. So the more that we have hands-on projects, the more these kids light up.
I had the opportunity to fly along with those winners the last time.
That's
on the
right.
Zero-G flight. I'll tell you, my eyes lit up on that. But but to see those kids actually experiencing that for the first time is incredible. And I know, like, I've talked to many astronauts on the show before, and they always talk about the overview effect, which I know you and Mark have talked about from your time on Blue Origin, and wanting to be able to share that with the rest of the world. Do you feel that you're doing that through this kind of work? Is that kind of what drives you, is to bring that moment that you felt when you were at the edge of space and bring that back to Earth?
Absolutely. It was interesting because a couple of days before we flew out to Astronaut Village there in Van Horn, Texas, I was walking Saba, our mascot dog, the space dog, and all of a sudden it hit me. You know, the birds were louder. I could hear the water in the lake. And it kind of took my breath away because you have to face the fact that you are going to space and you have to prepare yourself both physically and mentally. And the intensity of it. And then once we got up in space, it was overwhelming. When you look back on Earth and you see how fragile our planet is and how thin that atmosphere is, it takes your breath away. And there's triggers. I get emotional about it, even in a couple years. But there's triggers that every time I see a launch or a countdown, it takes me right back there. And I will tell you, it is the most emotional and spiritual journey I have ever been on. And I am so grateful for the opportunity.
Do you think it will have the same emotional effect on the second time around? Are you more prepared for your next flight?
I'm prepared, but I don't think you are ever prepared for the ability to look back on Earth. I think it'll be just as emotional as it was the first time, because there's something about being up there. When you come back to Earth, you have a responsibility to make it better. It changes you.
My producer, Marion, who's here in the studio with us, her and I had a chance to check out the simulator of the new Shepard capsule at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Even that, even knowing that was, you know, that was simulated, it was augmented reality, it was very immersive, but it was also very emotional. Marion is nodding in the studio here. And to know that was the same view that you saw is kind of giving me chills right now as well. Did you talk to anybody before you went up there to mentally prepare for that image? I mean, there's only been about 600 people that have experienced that at this point. How did you prepare for that?
Well, to go back to the visitor center at the complex, I was over at KSC just recently, about a week ago, and Hootie, who's over at Blue Origin, said, come on, we're going to go over and do the capsule. You'll be the first Blue Origin astronaut to actually take the simulator. So the people over there were kind of nervous because they didn't know how I was going to react having actually been in space. It is very realistic. They did a great job. And if you haven't gone, you need to go over there and experience that.
And that's a really great example of bringing this opportunity that is very limited right now to more people, right, is to be able to have that experience where people like Marion and myself can try that out, but also some of these kids that are going through your program as well. I mean, do we need more of that? And I think I know the answer to this.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you brought up how many people have been in space to date. And out of the 8 billion people at the time that we were launched, I think it was just over 610 or 12 people. Because my husband was a gentleman, I became the 599th person to cross over the Kármán line. He was the 600th.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. That's awesome.
But the most important thing is I was the 74th woman. And that's why we need more girls.
Companies like Blue Origin are building that access. They're building these opportunities. There are other opportunities to get into space as well. You know, where do you see us in 10 years from now? Are these first kids that you've worked with at Space Kids Global will be entering the workforce? Are they going to have, sorry.
Oh my gosh, that's right.
Are they going to have these opportunities? And where do you see them going?
Oh my gosh, that's a good question. But I really feel very strongly that these kids that are being exposed to all these new hands-on projects that are really resonating with this, I think they'll be in the space industry at some level. For example, we took our grandsons as our plus one when we went out to Van Horn, and the oldest one wasn't old enough to come out to the recovery launch. Mm-hmm. But because we were delayed 2 days, his birthday was during that time, so he came out and greeted us when we came out of the capsule. He has now changed his major. He's a freshman at Stanford, and he's studying aerospace engineering. And that was just a glimpse. Can you imagine these kids that are growing up with this now?
That shows you the power of being exposed to something like that. And finally, Sharon, to round out this conversation, this group of kids that will win this contest, they're going to be exposed to all sorts of different incredible opportunities in both the private space industry and through, you know, the federal program at Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Tell me a bit about what you want them to take away. What is the mission objective for that core group that is going to be following along your next mission?
Our goal is to really get to know these kids and be interviewing them at the time to find out what they think a launch is like. And they'll be interviewing each other, and like I said, workers at Blue Origin and us as astronauts. But at the end of the day, how did it change their life? Because they are part of the mission. And more importantly, they now know somebody that's up in the capsule, which changes your whole perspective.
It gives them a much greater connection to the story, right?
And hopefully that we'll have, you know, one of the major TV stations pick up on this and have one of the kids come on and talk about the experience. Because we want them to go back to their communities and report back to their local communities of what this experience has been for them.
And we'd love to have them on this show too, Sharon.
Absolutely.
Sharon Hagel is the founder of Space Kids Global. She is a Blue Origin astronaut and 74th woman to pass the Kármán line. Sharon, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you for having us. And spread the news. Go to spacekids.global and sign up your kids. Between the ages of 8 and 12, we hope to see you soon.
Still to come, the mission back to Venus is back on track. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. It's been almost 40 years since a robotic spacecraft has visited the planet Venus. That was set to change this decade with a new mission to Venus, but those plans were derailed by funding issues. Darby Dyer is a professor of astronomy at Mount Holyoke College and senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute. She fought for the funding to make this mission possible, and after visiting congressional leaders, that mission is now back on track. She joins us now to talk more about her fight for the mission and why her team is studying Venus in the first place. Darby, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be back.
A lot has happened since we last had you on to talk about Veritas. Tell us a bit about what happened and the fight to get this mission back on track.
What a 2 years it has been. So let's see. The history of this is that back in October of 2022, we were told by NASA that due to overcommittedness at JPL and budgetary problems and some other issues, that they were going to put us on an indefinite stand down. And they gave us $1.5 million to pay for about 12 people on the science team on a kind of a shoestring budget. And there we sat for months and months and months. One of the best things to me that happened during that period of time was there was quite a bit of furor in the planetary science community. And as you may not know, the planetary science community is sort of organized into these analysis groups. The analysis groups represent each body. There's one for Venus, there's one for Mercury, Mars, et cetera. And the analysis groups very rapidly, within a few months, came up with a recommendation or a finding to NASA in favor of funding Veritas before NASA did anything else. And it was really amazing to see how unselfish people from all the different communities in planetary science were. That was sort of step one. Step two, as you are probably aware, Mars sample return has gone over budget and has encountered some problems. And so headquarters has had a lot of desire to fulfill commitments and not enough money. So seeing this about a year ago, the Planetary Society, which is a nonprofit that promotes planetary science, came to the aid of Veritas and suggested that maybe lobbying would be a good thing. So Darby goes to Washington with the wonderful assistance of Jack Caralli at the Planetary Society. And I visited 106 congressional offices. I bounced into each office and said, "Hi, I'm Darby Dyer. I'm a Venus scientist. I want you to fund our mission." I also happened to have a Mars meteorite in my pocket, and we got a lot of attention. And it was very gratifying to see that ultimately, in the appropriations language for both the House and the Senate, they put the exact language that we had lobbied for. So it was worth the loss of shoe leather for me to feel like I had made a contribution to helping us get funded. So all of that happened. We waited and we waited. Headquarters, to their credit, was very constant. They said, "We will let you know something in March 2024. Waited patiently, and finally in March 2024, I think on the morning of the 10th, maybe, they called us and said, "Okay, we're bringing you back up. It's all go ahead and go." So the only sad part is that the mission's been pushed back. We were originally supposed to launch in 26, and now we're going to launch in 2031. That's a little frustrating, but we're happy to be back on the table.
We've spoken with NASA Administrator Bill Nelson on this show quite a bit. One of his go-to phrases is, "It's not rocket science, it's political science." Did you ever imagine that you, Darby the scientist, would be lobbying congressional lawmakers to get the money that you need for your mission?
Well, it's funny, you know, because for years, I've been teaching planetary science classes to students, and one of the hallmarks of those classes, and the students laugh because I say it so often, is that planetary science is intimately related with both history and politics, and you can't really separate them. So it finally caught up with me, that message. I've never set foot in any of the congressional offices until this past year. I'm not very comfortable doing it because that's not my skill set, but I think I learned a valuable lesson, which is that you can make a difference. And especially if you're passionate about something. So, I mean, obviously, I'm only a small cog in the whole effort to get Veritas back up, but at least it was very satisfying to be able to have something to do, because we were kind of sitting around on standby and planning our undergraduate projects. But and we also did, I should mention, the Veritas team used that funding very productively. We, with the help of the German space agency, DLR, we did a field study in Iceland last summer. So that's what we used our pennies for. And the field study combines radar and spectroscopy like Veritas. And we've gotten some amazing results. You know, we're already off to a great start, even on a shoestring budget. So I can only imagine what we're going to do next.
What was it about the Mars asteroid that made lawmakers fund a mission to Venus? What was the pitch?
Well, the pitch is sort of threefold. The first one is that many people are now aware that exoplanets are being discovered around other stars at an enormous rate. and that many of them, mostly because of observational bias, Venus distances from their suns. So that's a very intriguing and brand new observation. Another brand new observation in the last decade has been that we now suspect that Venus had liquid oceans for about 3 billion years. And this is in contrast to Mars, which only had liquid oceans for 300 million years. So a lot longer and a lot more Earth-like scenario. In fact, Venus probably had liquid water before Earth did because, you know, a solar system heats up from the center. So I think that realization was part of the compelling justification for the emphasis on Venus. And then the last thing, I can't help but tout the work by some of the other people in the Veritas team. Robbie Herrick and Scott Hensley were looking at some 30-year-old Magellan images. Maybe you saw this paper about 6 months ago. And they found an area where we see in on one pass, we see no volcano caldera. And then the next pass, we see an expanded caldera. So there's now evidence for active volcanism on Venus. And we've never seen active volcanism on a terrestrial planet. We've seen it on Io, but never actually seen it on a terrestrial planet. So anyway, those three things, the fact that Venus is so much like the exoplanets that, and is so common in the solar system, the fact that we had water for so long, making it probably a much better target in terms of thinking about habitability than Mars, and then the fact that there's probably active volcanism, all of those things, you know, the support from the community, the lobbying, all of that combined to bring us to this point where we were, as the expression goes, stood back up.
Well, I mean, that's super exciting that volcanism was found on the planet. But as you mentioned, that was from data that's, what, almost 30 years old at this point, more than 30 years old at this point. Like, what more is this new mission going to bring us to understanding the planet of Venus?
So Veritas has three big investigations. One is a radar investigation. One is a spectroscopy. And the third one is gravity science. So here are the things we're going to do. We're going to be able to identify surface features at resolutions that are more than an order of magnitude better than the Magellan mission. And just to put that in perspective, you all know what the San Andreas fault looks like. Well, you can't see the San Andreas fault at Magellan resolution, but you can at Veritas resolution. What does that mean? It means that we'll probably be able to actually determine whether Venus had, has, or will have plate tectonics. So just having a better topographic data set is just amazing. And it catches us up with all the other terrestrial bodies like, you know, Mars and Mercury, et cetera, et cetera. So that now we can actually do some better planetary comparisons because we have better topography data. And then we can, as I said, figuring out whether plate tectonics is happening.
And that will be a big deal, right? I mean, that's huge.
Absolutely. So because, of course, we've never observed plate tectonics anywhere else in the solar system. And as with many things, we don't know whether plate tectonics on Earth is a one-off or whether it's something that is just part of planetary evolution. So there's some very tempting teasers out there. In the Magellan data, we see things that look like, oh, like the Aleutian Arc off of Alaska. We see things that are topographically at the resolution of Magellan, very similar to those trenches. So there's a lot of sort of teaser data out there that suggests that maybe we are going to find plate tectonics. And that also has, most people don't realize, has implications for habitability because plate tectonics actively recycles water from the surface into the interior and then back out again through volcanoes. And then, of course, water comes out through volcanoes as steam and it enters the atmosphere. So plate tectonics is a really important thing in creating the hydrologic cycle. And in that way, supporting the possibility of a habitable environment for life to thrive.
What are the other two things the mission will do?
Veritas is also using spectroscopy to make a map for the first time ever. And the reason this is difficult is because Venus has a very thick CO2 atmosphere, and so you can't do conventional cameras in orbit around Venus. However, CO2 does have a few tiny places in the wavelength space where you can actually see through the atmosphere. And so we're using machine learning to figure out how to get the observations from those tiny windows into a format that will allow us to look at the rock type. And I find that particularly exciting because I'm a spectroscopist. And then finally, the third investigation, gravity science, will tell us something about the core and interior structure of Venus, about which we know very little. So those are the three foundational efforts. But I'm most excited about making a true geologic map of the surface of Venus, which will have accurate topography and on it superimposed chemical information that will inform the rock type. I cannot wait to do that.
Does the delayed launch affect any of the science that will happen, or is it just the fact that it's going to take longer for you to get your hands on that data?
It will affect the scientists.
You got to wait a little bit longer.
I am 66 years old, and I'm going around telling people I'm taking my vitamins and working out every day. I'm a rower, and I'm going to keep doing that. I want to stay in here until I get the data back. I mean, there are some sort of technical problems, obviously, because when we design a mission, as is often the case with NASA, you use a certain era of technology when you propose the mission, and you need to make sure that your proposed technology does not either become obsolete or become unavailable, worse yet, as time goes on. So that's our biggest problem, in addition to the fact that when we lost the engineering team, we lost a lot of incredibly talented people at JPL and other places. So we're hoping we can get many of those people back. But other than that, the pushback, the data will be worth waiting for. And, you know, we've been working at this for a long, long time. In 2010 was when Veritas was first proposed. So that's 14 years ago, right? So when you're in this game, you have to learn to be patient.
And finally, Darby, the mission, as you say, has been stood up. Is there the kind of fear in the back of your mind that it may be knocked down again and you have to do this once more? Or are we smooth sailing until 2031?
You know, you're talking about my worst nightmares.
I'm sorry.
I feel like the circumstances that have brought us to being stood back up are such that I doubt it if we will get stood back down. One of the conversations I've had about this that was the most gratifying was I managed to catch Nikki Fox at a meeting recently, and I went up to say thank you for standing us back up. And Nikki just looked at me and said, Darby, it was an obvious decision. And just smiled at me and said, you know, you go. But I feel like there's support from all quarters now for Veritas and recognition that we're going to provide a boatload of data. And it's foundational data. I think we're going to be okay.
Well, Darby, I'm going to make sure I take my vitamins and exercise so I can stick around for your data as well. Darby Dyer, thank you so much for joining us again and bringing us a wonderful update about this mission.
No, thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.